Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Ethiopia's war-scarred Tigray region, there's deep concern for thousands of Eritrean refugees whose camps have been looted and burned to the ground. The whereabouts of thousands of refugees who have scattered is unclear, the UN refugee agency UNHCR said on Friday, after gaining access to Shimelba and Hitzat settlements for the first time since conflict erupted on the 4th of November. Here's UNHCR spokesperson Boris Chezyokov.
Most of the shelters in an area known as Zone A, as well as UNHCR's offices and staff guest house, were burned to the ground. The mission confirmed what satellite imagery and accounts from refugees had indicated at the beginning of this year. UNHCR is deeply concerned for the well-being of the Eritrean refugees who had been residing there, all of whom have fled the camps.
Around 20,000 refugees had been living in the two camps prior to the crisis which erupted last November, when Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed launched a military campaign in Tigray after accusing the region's governing party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, of attacks on army camps. 100 million more children than were expected now have trouble reading because of school closures linked to COVID-19. The warning from UNESCO, the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Agency, comes in a new report which shows that basic reading skills were already on a downward curve before the pandemic. In 2020, instead of 460 million children having reading difficulties, that number jumped to 584 million as a result of the pandemic. Schooling has been disrupted for an average of 25 weeks since the beginning of the pandemic, UNESCO says, with learning losses expected to be highest in the Latin American and Caribbean region and in Central and Southern Asia. To tackle what the UN agency has called a potential generational catastrophe, it is calling for schools to reopen with greater support for teachers, initiatives to prevent pupils dropping out, and an acceleration of the availability of digital learning tools. It's convening education ministers from all over the world on Monday, the 29th of March, to discuss these recommendations. To Angola, finally, where hunger is on the rise in the southwest as families endure the worst drought in four decades. The alert from the World Food Programme, WFP, is for the provinces of Kwanza Sul, Benguela, Huambo, Namibe and Huila, where harvests are down around 40%. In addition to chronic food insecurity and malnutrition rates, the situation is also causing displacement as families move towards other provinces and across the border to Namibia to feed themselves and their livestock. In 2019, drought had already affected 1.6 million people in Angola, a situation that continued into 2020. WFP said in a statement that it's helping by coordinating food security and nutrition assessments in the south of the country and supporting school meals programs along with government partners. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello, in this week's show we're celebrating 7 years without polio in India and finding out how it was done. Could the lessons learned help to overcome COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy? Also, the UN Human Rights Office announces a probe into grave rights abuses in Ethiopia's Tigray region. A call for solidarity for the tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees who've lost everything in a huge campfire in Bangladesh. And a call for an emergency summit to stop the violence in Myanmar. That's all coming right up. But first, the news. Alleged serious abuses and rights violations in Ethiopia's Tigray region are to be investigated by the UN, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, said on Thursday. The probe, which will be carried out jointly by the High Commissioner's Office and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, is described as part of the much-needed accountability process for the victims. The development comes after fighting began in the North Ethiopian state on the 4th of November last year between forces loyal to regional power brokers, the TPLF, and national government forces. Serious human rights violations and abuses have been reported, the UN Rights Office said in a statement. It pointed to the multiple actors involved in the conflict and the gravity of the reported violations and the need for an objective, independent investigation which will start as soon as possible and for an initial period of 3 months. To Myanmar now, and an appeal from rights expert UN Special Rapporteur Tom Andrews for greater international pressure to resolve the deepening crisis there that's followed the military coup on the 1st of February. Conditions are deteriorating, Mr. Andrews said on Thursday, warning that the situation will likely get much worse without an immediate, robust response in support of those under siege. To date, more than 120 people have been killed by security forces, according to UN independent rights experts, and the UN Human Rights Office has condemned the soaring death toll. Mr. Andrews underlined the ineffectiveness of sanctions, which have left the most lucrative business assets of the junta unscathed. In a call to UN member states, including those in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the European Union, the United States, and China, the special rapporteur urged them to hold an emergency summit to provide a focused diplomatic solution to the crisis. The Rohingya refugees, who lost everything in a massive fire at a camp in southern Bangladesh, need the world's support more than ever. That's the message from the UN's Emergency Relief Chief, Mark Lowcock, who's released $14 million from a central fund to support thousands of families at Kuttupalong camp in southern Bangladesh. Monday's blaze uprooted more than 45,000, mostly ethnic Rohingya. The cause of the fire is still unknown, as is the exact number of casualties at the camp. UN Children's Fund spokesperson James Elder told UN News shortly after the blaze was brought under control.
UN teams on the ground have been reporting over the last sort of 12 hours that they've not really ever seen anything of this scale and intensity that has ripped through homes where you've often got 10 people living in a small shanty as a family or as an extended family. So the UN reporting at the moment that at least 15 people are dead, 400 are missing, tens of thousands who again were already living in a very difficult situation, tens of thousands have lost what they called their homes and whatever meager possessions they had.
In a statement on Thursday, Mr. Lowcock described the refugees who fled what top UN officials have likened to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar in 2017 as one of the world's most vulnerable communities. They need our support now more than ever as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to take its toll, and with the approaching monsoon season, the UN Emergency Relief Coordinator explained. This is UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson, from the UN News Team. Thanks for listening. Now to this week's interview, which is a good news story from India. This Saturday, the country will be celebrating 7 years without polio, and this in a place that's been described as one of the most difficult to eradicate this preventable and debilitating disease. To find out how it did it, I've been speaking to Deepak Kapoor, chair of UN partner Rotary International's Polio Plus Committee.
I am absolutely delighted that on the 27th of March this year, we will be celebrating 7 years of certification of a polio-free India. It was and remains a momentous occasion in our lives.
What does it mean for children and families in terms of their futures made safe?
It is absolutely amazing relief for all mothers, fathers, and the children themselves to know that the specter of polio, the menace that the polio virus poses, is no longer going to affect the lives of the immunized children. We've just got to make sure that the drops keep going into the mouths of all the children until the whole world is free of polio. For that, we have to keep immunizing and not forget that in 1988, India used to report 450 cases of polio every single day.
Is there any way that COVID might help eradicate polio, this paralyzing disease, in those last two countries, wild polio disease in Afghanistan and Pakistan, given the infrastructure that partners such as yourself, Rotary International, have in getting to rural and remote communities?
Today, we have first-class health systems in developing countries like India, which can help tackle not only polio, but also help in the fight against COVID. We've got to try and promote immunization against polio, measles, rubella, diphtheria, you name it. And I think each of these fights would benefit from that.
Let's talk about then another thing that we haven't mentioned, and that's suspicion of vaccines. And with your polio eradication efforts, you certainly encountered some resistance from minority communities. How do you get into those communities?
There was a point in time when the entire polio eradication initiative, effort, drive, call it what you will, in India was completely at a standstill. And the reason for that was the suspicion in some of the minority communities in India that the vaccine was being used to limit the number of people from their community in the country. That was one. And the second was that the vaccine contained some substances, parts of an animal, that were forbidden under the religion. What we really did, because it was such a sensitive religious issue, the partnership gave Rotary the responsibility of heading this. And Rotary formed an ulema committee. Ulema means a distinguished teacher. But eventually, after months and months of efforts and meetings, we managed to get them all in one room and talk the same language. And suddenly, there was a sea change in the entire scenario, where people used to resist immunization actively. Suddenly, from every mosque in the country, all would go out on every Friday, asking the faithful to come to prayer and to take their children to the nearest polio booth. Now, this is the kind of democracy that we will have to promote, because in the case of COVID, it's not only 172 million people in India, the children in India, but we are talking of a massive population, as you know. And it's everyone, especially in the 18 plus age group, that has to be immunized. It is a massive, massive task. However, the same lessons that we learned from polio in combating hesitancy in accepting immunization, I believe, can be utilized in COVID, a fight against COVID.
And my last question to you, as Rotary International and partnering with the World Health Organization and others, you've been tackling polio since 1988. Please tell me it's not going to take, 20, 30 years to get back to normal after we've managed to vaccinate people against COVID.
You know, beginning in 1988, when we thought that polio would be finished and wrapped and done with in maybe a couple of years or 3 years, we are today in 2021 still talking about two more endemic countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Really speaking, the infrastructure is all there. A vaccine is available. The will, political will, and the bureaucratic will is there in both those countries. Of course, there are issues about security and so on. You know, when we talk of the end of polio anywhere, I'm reminded of the words of a WHO, World Health Organization expert, who said to me when we were pretty frustrated right towards the end of 2009 or 10, that how long will it take us? So he said, think of the polio virus as being the rubber ball, but a different sort of rubber ball. When you drop a rubber ball, it bounces each time a little less than the last time. But polio is not like that. Here you will find, you keep your act together in India, and one day the rubber ball will drop and not bounce up. And that is exactly what happened on the 13th of January, 2011, when we had our last case of the wild polio virus. And I believe that in the case of COVID, if we get to most of the population, 90 or 95% plus across the world, this could go sooner than we anticipate.
Rotary International's Deepak Kapoor, and you're listening to UN Catch Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. And with me on the line is Solange Behotege-Cortez from UN Geneva's Information Service, as ever. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel.
Nice to hear your voice again. So tell me about this, Solange. It's another good news story. First, we had Cambodia making great progress against HIV last week, and now, this week, we have India beating polio 7 years on the trot. Are you on the floor in shock?
Absolutely. I'm on the floor, but delighted. 7 years of certification of polio-free in India is excellent news. Receiving this news when the world is going through the COVID crisis, it's even better and very encouraging. It's like a secret voice telling us you can defeat this virus. It's just a matter of time. And I hope, like you, Dan, that it's going to take less than 23 years to do it. Listening your interview with Deepak Kapoor, we see that the Indian success story is a combination of political will, public and private partnership, but also combating hesitation and building confidence in vaccination. We've all seen a child victim of polio, or at least a photograph. It's an image we'd rather not see. But the worst thing is to think that it could have been avoided with a jab that never came. We have an historic opportunity to fight COVID-19 using vaccines as a weapon against the virus. Let's keep in mind that getting vaccinated remains a far, far, far smaller risk than not having one. But there must be vaccines for all. As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said, vaccine equity is the biggest moral test before the global community. We must ensure that everybody, everywhere, can be vaccinated as soon as possible.
Thanks for that, Solange. Totally agree with you. And according to the latest update from the World Health Organization, only 403 million vaccines have been administered globally. So really a long, long way to go. And perhaps just a little bit more information quickly from the UN Health Agency on the latest COVID-19 data. Confirmed cases continue to rise around the world for a fourth consecutive week, with 3.3 million new cases reported in the past seven-day period. Deaths leveled off in the same period, but were still at 60,000 in a week, with Europe and the Americas continuing to account for nearly 8 in 10 of all cases and deaths. Notable increases in the number of new infections in Southeast Asia, the Western Pacific, Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean. More information from the WHO's COVID dashboard, www.covid19.who.int. So with that, it just remains for me to thank you listeners for your time, for catching up with the UN's work, and to you, Solange, for your comments as ever, and Justine Bryce, who is working hard behind the scenes to make this podcast available online. Catch you next week. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye for now. This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. Alleged serious abuses and rights violations in Ethiopia's Tigray region are to be investigated by the UN, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, said on Thursday. The probe, which will be carried out jointly by the High Commissioner's Office and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, is described as part of the much-needed accountability process for the victims. The development comes after fighting began in the North Ethiopian state on the 4th of November last year between forces loyal to regional power brokers, the TPLF, and national government forces. Serious human rights violations and abuses have been reported, the UN Rights Office said in a statement. It pointed to the multiple actors involved in the conflict and the gravity of the reported violations, and the need for an objective, independent investigation, which will start as soon as possible and for an initial period of 3 months. To Myanmar now, and an appeal from rights expert UN Special Rapporteur Tom Andrews for greater international pressure to resolve the deepening crisis there that's followed the military coup on the 1st of February. Conditions are deteriorating, Mr. Andrews said on Thursday, warning that the situation will likely get much worse without an immediate, robust response in support of those under siege. To date, more than 120 people have been killed by security forces, according to UN independent rights experts, and the UN Human Rights Office has condemned the soaring death toll. Mr. Andrews underlined the ineffectiveness of sanctions, which have left the most lucrative business assets of the junta unscathed. In a call to UN member states, including those in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the European Union, the United States, and China, the special rapporteur urged them to hold an emergency summit to provide a focused diplomatic solution to the crisis. The Rohingya refugees, who lost everything in a massive fire at a camp in southern Bangladesh, need the world's support more than ever. That's the message from the UN's Emergency Relief Chief, Mark Lowcock, who's released $14 million from a central fund to support thousands of families at Kutu Palong camp in southern Bangladesh. Monday's blaze uprooted more than 45,000, mostly ethnic Rohingya. 11 people died and hundreds are still missing. In a statement on Thursday, Mr. Lowcock described the refugees who fled what top UN officials have likened to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar in 2017 as one of the world's most vulnerable communities. They need our support now more than ever as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to take its toll, and with the approaching monsoon season, the UN Emergency Relief Coordinator explained. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Mr. Abubakar Koulibaly, thank you very much for talking to UN News today.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you for having me.
You are heading this UNDP mission to Cabo Delgado. You are now, right now in Pemba, the capital city, to support the response to the crisis. Could you tell us what is exactly the situation right now?
The situation in Cabo Delgado is very complex with a multidimensional crisis going on. We have, since January, a surge in displacement in the province. Those people live in their house because of insurgent group attack on their villages, are dispersed in the province of Cabo Delgado, Nampula, and Niassa. This crisis is adding to another crisis, which is COVID, hitting very hard in Cabo Delgado. So the population is facing a multi-layer crisis. 80% of the displacement now are in host community, not in camp. This is a very serious issue because it stresses the resource, the response capacity of the community, of the authority. The population has been generous, but the resources are limited. So when you host people from this difficult situation, you have to share everything. So it's very difficult for them, for displaced people, but also community hosting them.
And when you say host communities, they are being welcomed by other families, right?
Yeah. We went on one neighborhood in Pemba, for example, where you can see the situation very clearly. You have in that neighborhood 25,000 population and 9,000 are displaced population. So the neighborhood normal population is 16,000, and you add more 9,000 to the population in that neighborhood where you don't have sustainable and durable shelter. You have drainage system that's broken, and this population is exposed to health issues if we have to deal with flooding situation in the neighborhood with no proper drainage system. More population will be exposed to diseases like cholera and other things.
Have you had the chance to talk to the Mozambicans affected by this crisis?
Yes. Since our arrival, we went to the neighborhood to talk to people. We went there with the municipal authority, but also we visited a resettlement site in Marikwani, Nanzua B, where you have 5,000 displaced population with 950 families. They said to us they don't have enough food. The health service is limited. There is no school for the children. I know humanitarian has planned to distribute food, but additional effort must be taken to avoid food crisis, hunger in those resettlement sites. UNDP has been providing support on livelihood in coordination with WFP, but I think we need to add more capacity to what we are providing.
So take us through, if you can, the roots of this conflict. So what happened there and what needs to happen in order for the situation to be normalized?
The crisis in northern Mozambique is very, very complex. It's important to know the root causes of this conflict and the crisis they are facing. But I think the most important issue is to understand that beside the vulnerability linked to high poverty rate, this province is in the ranking in Mozambique, the last province in the country. Yet the province has the highest health of natural resources. They have liquefied natural gas reserve in Africa, the biggest, one of the biggest in the world, but development is lacking. So local grievances existed before the insurgency in 2017. In the extreme northeast, we have this extremist group intensifying attack on villages. burning houses, killing, and making some very violent attack on population. So if you mix that insurgency with the local grievances in terms of access to services, economic opportunity they are lacking, and the expectation that governance system has to be reformed, you will see a cocktail of crisis. So that's what we are facing here. We need to address them comprehensively. We need to address, yes, insurgency, terrorism risk that we have in the country, but also we need to speak to those local grievances. How, if I'm a youth in Cap Delgado, what is my option in terms of economic opportunity? What is my option to live better, to escape from crisis, but also escape from the climate risk that the province is exposed to have better life? So we need to have a comprehensive approach in dealing with conflict prevention, social cohesion, but also we need to provide more support to local government to have capacity to prevent, manage, and respond to crisis. And UNDP is seeking a comprehensive approach of dealing with conflict prevention, peace building dimension of it, so we can create in a space where development work can start. But also talking to provincial authority, we see there is a lot of space to strengthen the capacity of local government in terms of providing security service, justice, but also local registration for the population. If you're not registered, how can you access support, social protection services? But also you need to insist on the regional cooperation, because when we are talking about insurgent group, you will have fighters from abroad. So I think it's important for UN to support the idea that the government can enclench in the sub-region this regional dialogue in terms of cooperation.
You mentioned an element that is extremely important, the youth. How can we help engaging the youth in this quest for peace and avoiding them falling into extremism and radicalism?
Our approach will be youth and women will be targeted group to ensure they play their share role in the response. That's what we are focusing on, service provision, so they can have access to services, but also providing economic opportunity. The simplistic way to put it is, if the cost for me to join an extremist group or criminal behavior is less than living the condition I'm in today, I will join because I will change my life. So we have to look at the insensitive they will have to remain in a legal behavior and working to want the world to have better life. So they need opportunity for that. So you have $1 billion investment in a province, but a lot of youth, they don't have qualification. They are left out. How will you address that? I think we need to provide a response through vocational training, working in network with local private sector. So our approach will be focusing on those youth that's left behind. On the peace building side, it's important that people participate, because one of the elements that's important in conflict setting is how inclusive institutions are. If we have peace committee at the village level, at district level, or municipal level, and it's excluding women, it's excluding youth, we can reasonably say that we are doing a peace. So we need to be inclusive in all the things we will be doing to ensure that youth are part of the process of social cohesion, social dialogue, committee at their level, to contribute their own view and participate to the decision making. And UNDP response also focus on how we can be gender transformative in our response. We focus on how women can be economically empowered to play the role they are doing. There are several women now as head of household, dealing with how I can get food, how I can pay rent while I'm displaced. So it's important to provide some of the response to them directly in terms of income generating activity. But also we see a lot of these people, they are very skilled on things like art, but now there is no market. So how you recycle those people in a small trade activity so they can have regular revenue and have better life.
Joining UN News is Mr. Mohannad Hadi, Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Syria Crisis. Welcome, Mr. Hadi. We meet on the 10th anniversary of the Syrian war. Describe what the UN is doing for ordinary Syrians who are still caught up in this war, although it's no fault of their own.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's unfortunate that after 10 years, the United Nations is still having to provide humanitarian assistance to millions of people in Syria, between displaced people, between refugees, between people who lost their livelihoods. It's very unfortunate. I myself was a country director in Syria before the crisis started, and I never imagined that after 10 years of conflict, I will still be working as a humanitarian worker, providing aid to the people in Syria who has been affected by the population. This year, we estimate that it's approximately more than 13.7 million people who will be in need of humanitarian assistance. And here, I mean the variety of the humanitarian assistance. It's like you need the entire drop-down menu of humanitarian assistance for those people inside Syria, where the suffering of the people, women, children, elderly, it's really heartbreaking for somebody who works in the humanitarian field, but also for somebody who worked in Syria and seen Syria before the conflict started, let alone for somebody who comes from the region. It's really heartbreaking to see the situation in Syria and how this country now, the people of this country, the Syrian people, are facing all those challenges and difficult situations.
Mr. Hadi, what can concerned people listening to this interview do to help the UN and help the people of Syria to survive the ongoing conflict until some political solution is found to expedite it?
As you rightly said, what is needed now is a political solution. And let's be clear about it. The end of the crisis is what everybody wants, not only in Syria, but in the region and in the entire world. People can make a difference. Everybody can make a difference. There are two types of interventions people can do. First of all, we need to make sure that politicians apply pressure. Politicians who have influence, countries who have influence, governments with influence, apply pressure on all warring parties in Syria, on all factions, to make sure that they put their weapons aside and sit on a table, start talking about peace, start talking about the best interests of the people. It's time to put the interest of the people before any other interest. What is more important now is the Syrian people, is the future of the Syrian people and the future of Syria as a country. In addition to that, of course, until a solution is found, there is no alternative to the humanitarian support to the Syrians of people. As I said, millions and millions of Syrian people need different type of protection. And there are a lot of platforms, a lot of ways to donate money through the World Food Program, through UNICEF, other agencies, NGOs. This is the time really to stand by the Syrian people, to show them that it's not only that they're not alone in this world, they're not alone in this conflict. There are people who care. There are common values between the people in Syria and the people in the States, the people in Europe, in Japan, Australia, in Africa, and all continents. This is very important to make sure that the Syrian people are supported throughout this crisis.
Why is there any reason to hope that things can improve for Syrians? What are the urgent priorities right now?
There is nothing to doubt here that the Syrian people, despite of what's happening, are still optimistic people. There's always hope. We need to support that hope. We need to make sure that the Syrian people maintain this hope and maintain their determination to end this conflict and to rebuild their homes and to rebuild their life, their livelihoods. Without hope, really, we can't go forward. As I said, the Syrian people are in need of food, shelter, safe drinking water, education, protection, which is something that is extremely important for the Syrian people. Again, mainly here for women and children. We need to make sure that we support the Syrian people. Hope is there. We can never give up hope.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. When COVID-19 locked down Cambodia last year, people with HIV were afraid that they'd lose life-saving access to regular supplies of antiretroviral drugs. Fortunately, that never happened, thanks to a successful new medicines distribution scheme and a little bit of help from social media platforms too, as UNAIDS country director Vladanka Andreeva told UN News' Daniel Johnson.
So let me start from the beginning, and let me just say that when it comes to the state of play of HIV, Cambodia is doing really super well. It has been recognized as one of the 7 countries globally that have achieved the so-called 19-19-90 targets as early as 2017.
Can I just jump in there, Vladanka? What's that 19-19-90, please?
19-19-90 are global targets that have been set. The first 90 target speaks to the percentage of people that should know their HIV status. That's 90%. The second 90 speaks to the percent of people who know their status that are in treatment. And the very last 90% speaks of the percentage of people who are in treatment and their viral load is suppressed. Hence, they cannot really transmit HIV.
Right. So when COVID arrived a year ago, or just over a year ago now, in Cambodia, what were the fears? Were there concerns that there wouldn't be, with all the transport restrictions, that there wouldn't be a transfer of HIV medicines to the country?
You know, I think people living with HIV in Cambodia, as well, you know, as the rest of the Cambodians, were really under a huge stress. Not only a health stress, but also a lot of stress was put on the economy of the country. And I think in particular for people living with HIV, one of the fears was, would they have continued access to both prevention and treatment services? So, you know, early in the pandemic last year, what UNAIDS has done together with the National AIDS Program, with the communities and different local organizations, we did a survey. We went and we asked people living with HIV and so-called key population, men who have sex with men, people who use drugs, transgender people, sex workers, what are their fears? How can we help them? What's the access to prevention and treatment services for them like since the COVID-19 pandemic started? And based on those answers, we decided to introduce early monitoring, and we're really looking at early indication of disruption of services. Second, we try to be a bit more innovative in the way we are offering services. You know, usually, in particular, the prevention services are offered in outreach work, which means people are going outside when we know where key populations are and offering prevention services, education, access to HIV testing to them outside. However, now we have moved most of the offer for HIV prevention services in the virtual world. We're using different social media platforms to reach out to them, and we have introduced HIV self-testing as yet another option.
So you feared the worst when the COVID-19 pandemic really shut down the country, and that included the closure of the biggest and oldest HIV treatment site in the capital, Phnom Penh. That was repurposed, wasn't it, to help COVID-19 patients?
True. One of the first efforts that Ministry of Health has done since the onset of the pandemic is really to have a central COVID-19 center. Unfortunately, the chosen selection was the oldest HIV treatment site in the capital. So what we have done, again, collectively with Ministry of Health and the National AIDS Program, we have ensured smooth transition of all patients, and that was the largest cohort of patients in Phnom Penh, into a new treatment site. We have provided, in addition to the services that have been offered, plus additional counselors, just to make sure that people knew where to go next and how to take up their medicines. And we have also provided face masks and sanitizers. The second effort that we have made is really we have used COVID-19 as an accelerator for promotion of multi-month dispensing of treatment. What does that mean? Instead of going every month to pick up your antiretroviral treatment, Now, people can go and pick up their treatment every 3 months, and some of them even on 6 months basis. That means that they go less frequently to the treatment sites, which limits their exposure to COVID-19, but also saves them money that they would spend normally on transport.
So there's been no problem getting hold of HIV medicines during the pandemic and during the import-export restrictions that we've seen?
One of the biggest fears, obviously, was the potential indirect impact of COVID-19 on the supply chain. We were lucky enough that we have not recorded any shortages of medicine in Cambodia. We have started this multi-month dispensing before the onset of the pandemic. But, you know, 1 year ago, we had only 34% of people who are on treatment having access to multi-month dispensing. Today, we have more than 54% of people on treatment that have 3 or 6 months supply of their medicines.
And is there any stigma associated with HIV still in Cambodia, as there might be with COVID-19, or at least in the beginning?
Oh, we are still not immune to stigma and discrimination. And, you know, and this is sometimes coupled with a reluctance to disclose one HIV status, because the key population that I have referred to earlier on, men who have sex with men, people who use drugs, entertainment workers, transgender women, sometimes they buy or sell sex. And these people are really hard to reach with HIV intervention. And I think, again, this whole innovation of moving some of the services into the virtual space has opened a door to reach some of these unreached population and offer services to them, but also making sure that the uptake, particularly of HIV testing, as knowing your HIV status is very important, then you can know if and what prevention measures you should uptake, or if your HIV status is positive, how to get on treatment is very, very important.
UNAIDS is advocating that all countries, ministries of health and national AIDS programs, grant access to 3 months or more of antiretroviral therapy for all people with HIV, including refugees and migrants. So how many countries currently support this three-month, this multi-month dispensary of HIV drugs?
In this region, Asia and the Pacific, most of the countries have already adopted that into their national programs. And I think, you know, Cambodia is not unique by using COVID-19 as an opportunity, really, to scale up this initiative.
Water, pure, sweet, flowing water. All the water the villagers can use.
Marlon Brando lending his Oscar-winning talents to UN Radio in the mid-1950s for an uplifting report on an issue that, as the UN chief Antonio Guterres put it this week, remains a matter of life and death. Brando takes us to Bolivia, where a UN team drills for water to transform the lives of an entire village.
As Ben Hudson wrote in his letter to the UN's Technical Assistance Administration, the water is doubly welcome, for water contains minerals, minerals which are most beneficial in preventing goiter, which abounds in this area.
Welcome to another of our UN News podcast classics, where we dig into the unique audio archive that spans more than 70 years of UN Radio. I'm Matt Wells. We've been marking the launch of the International Decade for Action on Water here at UN headquarters on World Water Day itself. So it's an appropriate time to look back at one of the simplest but most effective ways that our teams and partners on the ground have helped improve public health and development over the decades. In a moment, we'll take you to the small town of Loma in El Salvador. But first, here's one of the greatest screen actors of all time, as you've never heard him before.
How do you do? This is Marlon Brando. And that man out there in the churchyard talking to the priest is Ben Hudson. He's an American hydrological expert. Now, Ben has been sent to Cotoca, which is a village in the mountain regions of Bolivia, by the United Nations Technical Assistance Administration at the request of the Bolivian government. You see, for 9 months of the year, there's plenty of water in Cotoca. But for 3 months, the hills are as dry as the hills of Cotoca. And water during that time is just about the most precious thing in the world for the people of that region. Right now, Ben is talking to Father Raphael, trying to make himself understood over the peeding of the bells.
"Our preliminary drilling," he shouts, "tells us that there's an underground stream here, Father, but we'll have to dig in your churchyard."
Father Raphael looks worried. "But it's only 6 days to the festival of the Virgin of Cotoca. We hold our festival here. The people expect it. You can drill, Señor Hudson, if you promise to remove your equipment before the 6th day. Can you do it?" Ben looks puzzled.
"Well, 6 days in such rocky ground. Well, it's not going to be easy. I'll try it, Father, but you and the people of the village are going to have to help. In order to keep my crew on the job constantly, you'll have to supply us with food and prepare it so my workers don't lose time."
Father Raphael beams. "A fair bargain, my son. Now, how soon can you start the drilling?" Ben's answer.
"Well, how soon can you start the feeding?"
This is really something to see. While Ben and his crew send the rotary drill deeper into the ground, the women of Cotoca work at their pots and pans. The well diggers are husky men, and their appetites are sharpened by the bracing mountain air. And Ben's only complaint is that the food is so plentiful, his men will have trouble getting back to work after the meal. One day, 2 days, 3 days. Drilling continues. So do the cooking and the eating. The sun is hot, work is hard, and Father Raphael is just a little bit worried. But then on the evening of the 3rd day, while the curious villagers are gathered around the drill rig, there is a rumbling and a gurgling on the ground. The welcome sound for which Ben has been waiting.
"Faster, faster," he urges,
and the motor has stepped up. Even the women stir the soup at a quicker pace. Then just before dark, the cap of the drill press flies off with a wonderful sound. Water. Pure, sweet, flowing water. All the water the villagers can use. As Ben Hudson wrote in his letter to the UN's Technical Assistance Administration, the water is doubly welcome, for water contains minerals which are most beneficial in preventing goiter, which abounds in this area. Cotoca need never again have its dry season because of this constantly flowing, deep-dug well. Now, the least amazed person is Father Raphael. In 3 days' time, water has been reached. Is there an explanation for this miracle?
"But of course," answers Ben Hudson. "What else do you expect when you drill on holy ground?"
Marlon Brando there, bringing one Bolivian village's fight for fresh water to life, all on his own, in a UN radio booth in 1956. The story was called The Well of Happiness, and you'll find it, along with dozens of other unique and unusual radio stories, in our audiovisual library archive at unmultimedia.org/AV library. Just 1 year earlier, UN Radio produced an equally vivid report from the Americas on the transformative power of running water, this time in El Salvador. It's called Water for Loma, and it tells the story of how one community turned the arduous task of carrying water pipes 5 miles up rugged mountain paths into a day-long fiesta.
Do you recognize this sound? Yes, it's a sound we hear every day. Water running from a tap. But not everyone can summon water with a twist of the wrist. And here lies my story, not actually mine to be precise. It was told to me by my old friend, Carlos Davila, who was a former president of Chile and who recently came back from El Salvador with this UN story.
Clean water means better health, something most of us take for granted and don't bother about. But for a great part of the world, water, an essential part of life, is too often an unknown means of death. Even in these modern days, millions of people die every year from waterborne disease. For the recorded report of what one village in Latin America did about its water crisis, here is H.V. Kaltenborn with a story of Water for Loma.
For a few moments, Father Osmara Alvarenga held the sputtering rocket in his hand. Then, with an awkward but effective gesture, he threw it high into the air. There was a loud report, followed by a series of staccato bangs as the rocket completed its explosive arc across the Salvadorian sky. This was a fiesta day for Guazapa, and more particularly for the neighboring village of Loma de Ramas. This was the day of the Great Water Project, the day that the people were to carry the steel pipes from Guazapa to Loma so that this mountain village in El Salvador could have a supply of fresh, running water for the first time. How did this all begin? Well, this scheme to bring water to Loma was one of 11 such projects submitted by sanitary engineers from the World Health Organization working with the government of El Salvador. A safe water supply is regarded as a basic step in protecting health, and that is why the World Health Organization was here in the first place. In some areas, wells were being dug. In others, they were erecting sealed pumps. The problem of Loma de Ramas was simple enough. This village of 400 souls had for too long been dependent for its water supply on a community pool. But in the dry season, that became a muddy trickle. And even when full, it was open to contamination because of the general unsanitary surroundings. Even primitive latrines were lacking. And yet, high up on the mountain overlooking Loma, there was a spring from which flowed water, fresh, crystal clear drinking water. This, the World Health Organization engineers decided, was just the right source of supply for Loma. But the village of Loma was a cluster of dwellings halfway up a 4,000 feet high mountain, separated from the nearest community of Guazapa by a river. So Loma was not an easy place to reach, even by mule. It took 2 hours to climb the only road from Guazapa, a twisting, rocky gully. So the situation was put up to the inhabitants. Would they volunteer to carry the necessary water pipes and other material from Guazapa to Loma? The response was enthusiastic, not only in the mountain village itself, but in Guazapa as well. Men, women, and children volunteered to join a great safari up the mountain. The local holiday was proclaimed for the following Friday, and 8 o'clock in the morning was fixed as the starting time. The church bells summoned the people. On this morning of the great Water for Loma project, all was bustle and excitement in the frame office of the alcalde, that's the mayor of Guazapa. Hot coffee, brewed in great pots, was ladled out to the volunteer carriers. For this would be an arduous trek, and the people would need to be refreshed, so they might complete the 5-mile climb up rugged mountain pathways and across the Guazapa River. Water pipes were laid out on the grass before the village church. Even these plain steel pipes had to have their decorations of gaily colored paper streamers. Round them stood the assembled villagers, as Father Alvarenga spoke to them, of the virtues of good neighborliness and how fitting it was to share one another's burdens. He ended his little sermon and gave them all his blessing. Out from the main square, the procession filed on the first stage of the trek. The men carried the long pipes on their shoulders. The women and girls, in the local manner, balanced the shorter pipes on their heads. This led down an uneven path between steep banks to the river Guazapa. Now at dry season level, most of the carriers were able to splash their way knee-deep across the rocky bed. The hard climb really began at the other side of the river. The sun burned down from a clear blue sky. The only cloud was far over to the west, a mixture of white smoke and steam spewed from the volcano of Izalco. The children, nimble as goats, seemed tireless as they stepped barefooted from rock to rock. While the main party was still negotiating the second half of the journey, the sudden whiz and bang of a rocket fired from high up on the mountainside announced the arrival of the first climbers to reach Loma. Seconds later, to spur the stragglers, came the raucous but cheerful blare of an old phonograph record, amplified through equipment that the engineers had improvised some days before. With cheerful, sweat-stained faces, the marchers quickened their pace for the last stretch, which happened to be fairly level. As each pair reached the little square in the center of the village of Loma, they unloaded their precious pipes and sank, exhausted but happy, into the shade of doorways or bushes to recover their breath and escape the noonday sun. One of the men who had made the climb was the oldest inhabitant of Loma, Señor Timo. Mr. Timo describes how he had been getting water. Do you walk far for your water, Mr. Timo? Oh, yes, more than 2 or 3 kilometers. In what do you carry it? In clay pitchers. And how long does it take to bring the water? A long time, at least 2.5 hours. Is that for each trip? Yes. And is it carried on the head? On the head. By the boys and girls? By the boys and girls. And how will you feel when you will have the water right in front of your house like a stream? Oh, very happy. We shall sing our praise. Then, speaking to the villagers, a rural nurse congratulated them on their readiness to work for this community project.
Ya cuando todos tengan aquí este material, pues llegarán, ¿verdad?, ya a instalar en las pilas, se les pondrán regaderas, se les hará baño.
Once your pipes are installed, you will have fountains, bathrooms and irrigation, and you will get strong and healthy with the good water which you will have. You already know the advantages of good water, and you have seen it many times in the movies, as well as the advantages of drinking pure water. You also know how, until you get this good water, to boil the water in order that the germs may be killed and we may keep healthy. And now, Dr. Francisco Sequeira, the health educator of El Salvador, who organized the climb.
No es fácil hacer lo que han hecho hoy, cargar esos tubos que pesan una barbaridad y sin embargo...
It isn't easy to do what you have done today, carry these extremely heavy pipes, but you have done it. Therefore, on behalf of the Health Bureau, we congratulate you and thank you. As I mentioned before, this is proof of the effort being made by the El Salvador government to help the people progress, especially those who, like yourselves, help themselves. By this time, some of the lads were ready to make music with their guitars and marimbas. There was the happy spirit in the air that comes from a tough job, well and truly done. It was time to celebrate. The village of Loma de Ramas is a spot so tiny that you couldn't see it on a map of the world, but the vision of its people has no such limitation. They know the importance of pure water.
That was Water for Loma, bringing this UN podcast classic episode to a close. We'll be back soon with more from our unique audio archive. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening.